Everybody knows Steve Jobs' dirty secrets, but what about Tim Cook's? We will talk to the author of Tim Cook's biography, Leander Caney, also the founder of Cult of Mac, coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 394, recorded Monday, March 18th, for Friday, April 19th, 2019. Leander Caney on Tim Cook. Welcome to Triangulation. I'm Megan Maroney, and this is a show where every week we talk to some of the most interesting people working in tech, writing about tech, doing amazing things. And today I'm super excited to talk to Leander Caney. He is managing editor and reporter at Wired News. He was most known for being the founder of Cult of Mac, both the blog, website, and not actually a cult, but a company, and also the author of many books, including Inside Steve's Brain, Johnny Ive, the genius behind Apple's greatest products, and the upcoming Tim Cook, the genius who took Apple to the next level, a book that is coming out or is out soon, depending on when you're watching this. It's out now, depending on when you're watching it. Welcome to the show, Leander.
Hey, thanks, Megan. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I have read nearly every Steve Jobs book, but this was the first Tim Cook book that I read. And it's amazing because he is a very private person. So hard to get information about him. Why write about Tim Cook right now?
Well, because he's, I think, obviously doing a really good job. Although I know that's controversial. I was looking at some of the comments that people had on, some of the early publicity the book got so far, and there's a lot of skepticism. But, it occurred to me last year that now is a good time to write about Tim Cook, because I think the jury was out, for these first few years since he took over, and the prevailing narrative was that, he's just riding Steve Jobs' coattails. He took over this amazing company, and he has just managed, he somehow managed not to mess it up. But when they became the first trillion-dollar company, I mean, that was really a huge milestone. And I think hugely significant, because it shows, that Tim Cook hasn't just taken over Steve Jobs' company. He's grown it massively. And I think it's too low a bar to say that he hasn't screwed it up. They're doing, I think, if you look at all the things they're doing and all the areas they compete in, they're killing it. Apple is doing better than the market in PCs, with its computers. iPhone continues to be the best business ever invented. The iPad, two new iPads were released today. That's doing amazingly well. It's an amazing business. Everything they do is doing really, really well. And I think a lot of it has to do with, with Tim Cook and his leadership.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at it two ways. You could look at it that he's riding Steve Jobs' coattails, or that he had giant shoes to fit into,
right.
And he's done it really well. And I mean, you write that he didn't try to be Steve. That was his most important thing. Like that, I think that's one of the most important parts of the book. He was Tim, and that's who he was. And talk a little bit about who he was. We'll get into his childhood, and you write about that. But who he was when he was asked to step into Steve's shoes.
Yeah, well, he was Steve Jobs' right-hand man, and had been for a number of years. And what I discovered, writing the book, one of the interesting things about Tim Cook is that almost, no one knew anything about him at all. And if you remember back to that time when Steve Jobs died, I think there had been maybe three or four major profiles of Tim Cook in his entire career before then, working for 30 years in tech, and he hadn't been profiled at all. I mean, he was completely a cipher. And I think this is one of the reasons why people were worried about Tim, because someone like Johnny Ive had a much higher profile. And if you remember that time, people were saying, well, Johnny Ive should be he's the genius behind all these products. He should be CEO. And I think that was mainly because he had a much higher public profile, whereas Tim Cook had absolutely none. But Cook had been running Apple for Steve Jobs, for perhaps five or more years as the de facto CEO. When Cook came into Apple in the late 90s, as the head of operations, and he really tied it up and fixed Apple's messed up manufacturing operation, which included getting rid of its factories and outsourcing most manufacturing to outside partners like Foxconn. But he doesn't really get, and this is a huge thing, had a big deal, had a lot to do with saving Apple, but he doesn't get any credit for it. And then since then, Steve Jobs gave him a series of different jobs and different responsibilities, including being the head of the Macintosh division, being head of sales, running operations, and then finally becoming COO. And it was almost kind of like a CEO training behind the scenes. You know, Jobs was giving him a bunch of different jobs inside Apple to train him up to be to eventually become the CEO. But because he got no press and because they never talked about it, it was a bit of a surprise, I think, to a lot of people when Jobs stepped down and named Tim Cook as his successor. And of course, Tim Cook didn't have a much of a public profile, so people didn't really know what to think of him. You know, they didn't know what they just sort of took it for granted that Steve Jobs had made a good choice. But up until that point, you know, really he hadn't had any press coverage, no public profile. No one really knew very much about him. That was a challenge for writing the book because, you know, there's not a lot of historical material to draw on. But, you know, it became clear when I was researching it that he'd been, Jobs' right-hand man and one of the major architects of modern day Apple, you know, helping not only, you know, build the company, but run it too. A major contributor to that.
So why was he a cipher? Like, I don't know exactly how Apple PR works, but I know that they only let people do profiles when they want that information to be out. You know, they're very tight with that sort of thing. So Tim Cook just say, no, thanks, I'd rather not? Or was it because ops is boring to people? Or were they not wanting to put him out in the press for profiles?
Yeah, it's because they didn't want to put him out in the press for profiles. You know, Apple's very, very secretive. It doesn't talk to the press at all, except when it has products to promote. They don't do, you know, executive profiles. They don't talk at all about how the company works. And they never have done. And it was really, they do a little more now. And in fact, Tim Cook has kind of opened up the curtains a little bit when he wants to talk about things that are important to him. So they've done profiles on, you know, say Lisa Jackson and Apple's environmental efforts under Tim Cook, you know, which is a big, big difference to the way it was under Steve Jobs. But before then, you know, Jobs would come out on stage a couple of times a year, introduce products. They might give, you know, one background story about, you know, their major new project, product that year, how that came to be. And that's about it. That's about all the press they would do. They definitely wouldn't allow reporters in to, you know, report behind the scenes and or do executive profiles or talk about what, you know, someone like Tim Cook has been doing in the supply chain and how he built it up to be such a massive, massive manufacturing engine. And that's, in fact, what intrigued me. You know, like the original genesis for the book was to look at Apple's manufacturing operation. And Tim Cook was a really good lens, you know, to try to look at that through because he built it. And then, of course, you know, now becoming CEO tells you a lot, I think, about the priorities of who was important and who had power, in Apple under Steve Jobs. Johnny Ive gets all the credit for designing these products, but they would go nowhere unless they're able to manufacture them so well and in such huge numbers for a massive global audience. You know, this is no longer like a mainly American company. It's a remarkable achievement, and I think that was what interested me was taking a look at that. You know, see how did he build that, and how does it work?
So let's talk a little bit about his childhood, because I think there's a lot of ways that shaped him, as it shapes all
right,
of us.
Right, for sure.
And he seemed to have, in some ways, a very idyllic childhood. It was a small town. He was a great student. He played in the school band. He worked at the drugstore with his mom. But it wasn't easy for him. I mean, he wasn't openly gay back then when he was in that town. We don't really know, but by all accounts, the people who knew him, he didn't come out in high school. Talk a little bit about how his childhood shaped him.
Right. Well, like you said, it was somewhat idyllic. He and his two brothers lived in this small town, Robertsdale, Alabama. It's a rural, and it's in a rural area, but it's like a local hub for the Gulf Shores too, which is like a big resort area just a few miles down on the coast. He rode his bike everywhere as a big, you know, fitness fanatic, and he was very popular at school. He was in the band, and he was also the business leader, the head salesperson for the yearbook for a couple of years running. Excelled in his academic studies, was voted very popular, and also like the top of his class. But like you say, you know, he was gay. He didn't come out, and from what I can tell from the people I talked to, you know, no one knew he was gay. And if he had come out as gay, he wouldn't have had a very good reception. You know, it's not only a very conservative part of the country, but it's also a conservative time as well. You know, going back quite a few years now, you know, not as accepted as it is today. But he kept it quiet. You know, he kept it private, like he does. You know, which is sort of typical of his MO, of his personality. You know, he kept it under wraps. So there was no major incidences that I discovered in my reporting anyway about that. But he does, one incident he does talk about was when he came across the Klan burning a cross on a neighbor's lawn one night. He said he was out riding his bike. It was early evening, and he went past his neighbor's house, who was it was a black family, and said that there was a that the Klan were burning a cross on the lawn, and he instinctively shouted stop, and one of the Klansmen raised his hood, and it turned out to be a local deacon of a church in town, not one that the cooks went to, but he recognized him as a church leader. And speaking about that after the event, you know, said it had a very, very profound impact on him, and made him a lifelong believer in inclusion and diversity, and you know, and these are values that he's, that as I describe in the book, in the later chapters in the book, you know, they very much inform how he became, you know, the kind of things that he prioritized as a CEO at Apple years later.
You talk about how in high school he won a trip to D.C. and he met the segregationist George Wallace, who, right, from Alabama, and how that had a great effect, sort of marred his trip a little bit, but had a great effect. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so like you said, he won a competition, a writing competition, and he got to meet Wallace, Governor Wallace, who was actually the governor of Alabama at the time, and a staunch segregationist. And because he was put up, he had to go on stage with him, he met him, and he shook his hand, and he said afterwards that he felt that that was a clear betrayal of his values. He wasn't happy about doing that, shaking the hand of someone who he so fundamentally disagreed with. And then he went up to D.C., and I forget what happened in D.C. Do you remember, Megan?
That he was unhappy in the trip, but that, yeah.
Yeah, I think mainly because of shaking Wallace's hand. But then, of course, Wallace turned out to be a really interesting character, didn't he? I mean, he had a fascinating history after this. He was someone tried to assassinate him, and he was put in a wheelchair. Then he renounced all his previous views, and he became, quite a vocal He repudiated his old values. Mm-hmm. So he's an interesting cat, George Wallace. But yeah, Tim Cook said he felt, you know, that he'd betrayed his own values as a teenager in shaking his hand.
It's interesting because, I mean, we think about the people that lead the major companies, you know, they're usually very similar, and Cook stands out just as being a minority and that he's openly gay. But it's interesting because it's a different kind of minority, right? Because he was able to hide that all throughout his youth. And you wonder, like, had he been open in the 60s, I mean, would he have been, you know, beaten up, or just, you know, everything might have been different. Like if you're a person of color, if you're a woman, like, you're not hiding that. You're like, here I am, this is who I am. And so then you might struggle to get to the position that Cook had, but whereas hiding it has its own kind of problems too. Do you think the fact that he did have to hide who he was for so long had an effect on who he is now?
Yeah, for sure. You know, he's so private, and when he came out, you know, it was very, very difficult for him to do that. He said so quite explicitly that he knew that he was going to be sacrificing something quite important to him, which is his privacy. But he wanted to do it for what he thought was a greater good. And there's no way. I mean, if you look at the history of this country and the way that, especially sort of attitudes towards gays, I mean, it's undergone a really, really profound change. I mean, it's really difficult to imagine the Supreme Court legalizing gay marriage. That came as quite a surprise, really, to be honest. You know, this was just a few years ago, but it came after a long, long period of, you know, sort of cultural normalization. And I think it had a lot to do with like TV shows like, Will and Grace and Modern Family, putting gay people in American life, you know, on TV, making them seem, you know, non-threatening, and it's really culturally quite normal and nothing to be worried about. So I think it's kind of impossible for someone like Tim Cook, you know, to look back to the late 70s when he was a high school student in a place like Alabama. I mean, like, I haven't lived in Alabama, so I can't say for sure, but I know things have changed in Alabama, but in his small town in rural Robertsdale, you know, I'm sure it would be tough to come out as gay even now. And not something that you'd want to do. And like you said, if he had come out as gay, I think it would have had a profound difference because, you know, at companies he worked at, like at IBM, very, very conservative company, they were famous for wearing, the IBM uniform, the white shirts and the black tie, and everyone was very conformist. You know, it's extremely conservative and conformist company. And I cannot imagine for a minute, you know, like in the 70s and early 80s, you know, someone like Tim Cook coming out as and saying that he's gay and not having an effect on his career. No, I think it would have had a profound effect. I think his career would have been derailed from the very beginning.
But by the time he did come out, they were worried about, because it wasn't just the South they were worried about. They're a global company, obviously. There's a lot of countries where people feel even less okay with homosexuality. But it didn't really affect the company at all when he came out, did it?
No, not at all. That was, I thought that was, you know, really quite a surprising cultural moment. Because it was no big deal. Nobody mentioned it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, an issue on the TV. You know, you can imagine outlets like Fox News maybe making an issue out of it, but it went with nary a peep. I mean, everyone just shrugged. and I think it just, you know, it was kind of like when Obama got elected president. You know, it was like, I think, you know, a lot of people were wondering whether a country like America was ready to have a black president. And then when he was black president, it was kind of, for a lot of people, it was like, it was great. It was affirming, you know, and you can see that in the inauguration. But I think with Tim Cook, everyone just sort of shrugged. It was like, yeah, no big deal. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about his early years. He graduated from college and his first job was at IBM, but he didn't have a real technical background. That was sort of that was the best business opportunity for him, right?
Well, he trained as an engineer. So he had an engineering degree and he'd taken, actually, at IBM, he started taking business classes. But so he had actually more of a technical than a business background. He was an engineer. So when he joined IBM, he was on a management track, and they put him on the shop floor, and he had a whole bunch of different jobs, maybe up to about a dozen different jobs, helping to run that factory, and eventually becoming like an executive assistant to the main plant manager. But he had a pretty good training there for 12 years, you know, helping run all different parts of the factory, including things like supply, you know, making sure that, because they were a just-in-time factory. And this had a lot to do with what he brought to Apple later on, was the expertise, you know, in just-in-time manufacturing, which at the time was a little bit, exotic. And mainly only car manufacturers, mainly Toyota, were doing it at the time. But IBM brought it to computer manufacturing. And it's very efficient. You essentially make computers on demand, but it's technical. It's tricky. You have to make sure you have enough parts at all times. You're really good at forecasting. You know, you're really good at getting supplies and keeping them. You know, keeping the whole thing moving. I mean, they were getting like 100 trucks a day coming into that plant with spare parts, and you know, none of those parts would sit in warehouses. They'd all be going out the door late at the end of the day as finished computers. So yeah, he. You know, he had a technical background and he had a very technical training at IBM.
So he went from IBM to Compaq, and then there was nothing in between, right?
There was a small company in between. Yeah, he went to Intelligent Electronics, and he was like, he was pretty high up there. He was like COO or something like that. He got recruited into a pretty high position in this company called Intelligent Electronics. They were based out of Colorado, Denver, I want to say, and they were kind of like a reseller. They put together systems, you know, for companies, what are they called? Value added resellers. So they were like a VAR, I think. But he wasn't there for very long. And then he got recruited to Compaq, and again, Compaq at the time, you know, was a massive, massive company, hugely successful. one of the biggest companies, if not the biggest companies in the PC manufacturing business. He was, again, in a high-up position there. Looked like he was going to have a really good career at Compaq. Yeah, so it's kind of surprising that he went to Apple.
And Steve Jobs actively recruited him for a long time, right?
Yeah, he'd been hit up by headhunters. And, of course, he just joined one of the most successful companies in the PC business, and he's trying to get recruited by one of the least successful companies in the PC business. Apple was really, really in trouble at that time, and it was losing sales hand over fist. It was its revenues as well. So I think they had one of the biggest revenues in Silicon Valley history just a few months before he joined. So it wasn't a good proposition. It wasn't a good sales pitch from Apple. To get him, it really looked like the company was could seriously go out of business. So it was a tough get. It was a tough get for and Steve Jobs turned on all the charm to get him.
And yeah, Cook says that that was why he came. You know, once he talked to him, he couldn't turn it down. But I mean, it's a great opportunity if you think of it. He could have, I think, looked at it and said, I can know how to fix this company. And he really did. Right. I mean, when he started, Apple wasn't doing, were they doing no outsourcing? I mean, they had that factory. When he started, did they still have the factory in the Bay Area somewhere? I can't remember.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they had a couple of factories. They had one in Sacramento. They had one in Fremont. They had factories in Cork and in Singapore. And exactly, yeah, they were doing a lot of their own manufacturing internally. And the idea was they had factories in Cork that would serve the European market. So they were making machines for Europe. The one in Singapore was making machines for Asia, and then the factories here were making them for the US. But it was so badly run that they'd do some partial assembly in Singapore, and then they'd ship the machines over here to California to have some parts put in them here in the States, and then they'd get shipped back to Asia to get sold finally over there, and vice versa. They were shipping machines all over the place, and it wasn't efficient at all. It was terrible. It was really, really badly run, really, really badly set up. So yeah, this is in the initial conversation when Cook finally went to meet Steve Jobs for an interview. Steve showed him the shell of the iMac. Remember the old bulbous blonde-eyed blue iMac, the first iMac, which is in development at the time. And of course, it was a pretty striking computer, and no one had seen anything like it then. And Tim Cook certainly hadn't seen anything like it. And he was just taken up with all the enthusiasm, Steve Jobs' enthusiasm for this machine, and like you said, he knew exactly how to fix the manufacturing operation. Apple had done some outsourcing then, but not, they've always done some outsourcing. They've done some outsourcing going back to the Apple II days. It's just I think it's a natural way that the supply chains worked and work now. They've done some outsourcing. They were doing some outsourcing with LG in Korea, just a little bit, but not too much. But and Cook didn't outsource everything at once. He just outsourced more and more parts as it made sense. And as the outsourcing partners, proved that they could do something really, really well, then they got the contract. And so it was something that he built up over a period of time. But that was definitely, where he was. He knew how to run a just-in-time factory, I think, really. That was really what his expertise was in doing. And that's what he brought to the iMac.
So I understand the concept of a just-in-time factory. But what is the opposite of that? What were they doing before? Just warehouses full of MacBooks?
Yeah. Yeah. Apple was really, really bad. They would either overestimate the number of machines they were going to build, and so they would end up with warehouses full of computers that weren't being sold, or they underestimated really badly, and so they'd have huge shortages. And they had both these problems before Tim Cook came along. And of course, for something like a computer, they're expensive, and a lot of the components are expensive. So Apple, had billions of dollars tied up in parts of computers that were either partially built or fully built and not getting sold. So all of that money, is a huge drag on its on its books, and with a company like Apple that was having trouble selling its machines in large numbers, in the numbers that it needed, this was sort of like existential kind of stuff, having a lot of its resources tied up in parts and in partially or completely manufactured computers that weren't being sold. So this is why it's super important for him to fix that, because it freed up a lot of money and a lot of resources for, that Apple desperately needed at the time.
You write about in 1998, there's a sort of incident shrouded in mystery where Cook apparently was responsible for sending tens of thousands of Macs to a landfill just to to get rid of them, get them off their books. Or talk about that, what you know about that. I know not much.
I guess, it's all shrouded in secrecy. And I really did a lot of digging and trying to find out what happened. And there's only a couple of reports of it, but apparently they had a whole bunch of machines they couldn't sell, and so Cook made the order to, you know, they'd be written off, and they ended up in a landfill up in Utah, I believe. And there was thousands of them. Yeah, so a lot of machines. It's completely antithetical to his image and his interest now, you know, of being a good steward of the environment and his interest in climate change and waste. You know, they just announced that they managed to get all of their big manufacturing plants are now 100%. They don't send anything to landfill, nothing at all. So it's a big change. Yeah, he would be, I'm pretty sure, mortified about that these days.
When you say you did a little digging, you didn't actually do physical digging.
No physical digging. No.
I hope they have a nice big fence around that landfill, because I know some people would try to do some digging, and probably worth a lot of money though.
Right, for these old machines. Yeah.
So right before Cook got there, you explained this, and I'm more probably in your Steve Jobs book. But when Steve Jobs took over, there were so many different. It was the Mac Performa. Was it the Mac Performa or the Apple Performa? It was the Mac Performa. But there were so many. There were just different numbers, and there was like just so many different computers. And you write about how Jobs said, you know, there was a flow chart to explain, and you said, well, if I can't understand it, he said, you know, if I can't understand this, how do we expect regular people to understand that? Now, do you think, I mean, we're recording this on the day that Apple just announced two new iPads, and we expect more. Do you think that they're inching back to that stage where there's just so many things on the product line?
Yeah, it can certainly seem like that. It's not as clean as when Steve took over. Like I said, you know, Steve, Apple at the time was making not just computers, but it was also doing monitors and printers and what do you call those things? I forgot what they're called, scanners. The Newton handheld, right. You know, almost everything that the computer industry needed, you know, Apple had a hand in. So it had lots and lots of products and also a really confusing of computers. You know, they had dozens of different variations, and Steve Jobs, you know, really cut it back to just four machines, and he had this famous matrix where it's two computers for professionals and two computers for consumers, and one desktop and one portable. So it was cut back to just, you know, four computers initially, which is the kind of thing you can only, and you know, Apple's, when he took that to Apple's board, they thought he was crazy. They thought it was suicidal. I mean, how can a company survive on just four products? And if any one of them is a failure, it could bring the whole company down. So it really was, you know, very, very risky. And if you look back on it, kind of like an amazing job that he did. They managed to pull that off and make that successful. Because they could have easily, and they almost did stumble a couple of times. The Cube almost like sunk the company when that wasn't a success. It's definitely getting back there. But you know, the company is very different these days, and they have all these different iPads. But you know, I was looking at someone had a spreadsheet on Twitter, and the important thing I think really is to hit all these different price points. You know, between the cheapest one I think is $299, the most expensive one is like $1,200, and they're hitting every sort of $50 price point. With phones, though, they are anyway, but and it's a little bit like that with the iPads, you know. But they're hitting all these different price points, so it's everyone's got an entryway in. And that's the most important thing. I don't think the you know, it's not quite as confusing as it was back in the late 90s. But it's definitely a little more. It's not quite as pure as when Steve Jobs took over. But then again, it's a very different company, very different market, much more mature. I don't think it's quite, you know, I don't think it's really disastrous yet. It's not anything to really worry about.
So let's talk about Foxconn. That was a huge deal that Tim made. And a lot of people, when they hear it, they think Foxconn, oh, you know, horrible human rights. And, you know, it is definitely different than what we know here by the way that they treat employees. But you write that it wasn't really about like low low wages wasn't what made Foxconn help Apple in their successes. Talk a little bit about Foxconn.
Sure, yeah. Well, Foxconn, you know, I did some digging around, and I didn't realize this, but for Apple's relationship with Foxconn goes all the way back to the Apple II. And Foxconn used to do some assembly for the Apple II, which is going back to the late 70s, early 80s. It's a very scrappy company. I mean, it was founded by Terry Gou, a Taiwanese entrepreneur. He borrowed some money. His parents were kind of middle class, well to do. He borrowed some money from them, and got into this computer assembly business, which is he really rode the coattails of the PC industry as it took off. And most of his work was actually with companies like Dell and Gateway. Dell especially, I think, was their big partner before Apple came along. And Tim Cook, I think, you know, I don't think they never had the plan to like just to outsource everything, and it never really was about getting the lowest possible labor costs. It's always about expertise, and about them being able to do to make these products, you know, better than Apple can do it itself. Really, to be honest, they've always had a very close relationship. You know, Apple sends in tons of engineers, tons of designers. People like Johnny Ive and his design team, they live for months in the factories, you know, working out how the products they've designed get made and made in huge numbers. And they have these massive, massive teams of engineers who know all, you know, the different aspects of manufacturing. And it's a big, big job, you know, to get like a product like the iPhone up and running. When they do a redesign, you know, it takes 2 or 3 years just to design the factories, the product line, you know, how they will go together in the factories. You know, the manufacturing process takes 2 or 3 years to finalize. So they started doing it, you know, bit by bit. Like I said, it started with the iMac iMac was doing LG. They outsourced to LG, and LG was doing the CRT, you know, the big the cathode ray tube, the screen of the machine, and they did such a good job of that they eventually got other parts of the contract, until eventually they were doing all of the assembly on that altogether, and then they took it to Foxconn, and Foxconn, you know, they've built it up over the years. You know, there's been a lot of talk about bringing manufacturing to the U.S., but it would be very, very tricky to do that because for many different reasons. One of them was I think they when they was trying to get set up a new factory, you know, they wanted engineers, manufacturing engineers, and Foxconn was able to assemble several thousand manufacturing engineers. And I think Tim Cook's on record saying that, you know, that there's you couldn't even if you pulled all the manufacturing engineers from every single school in the U.S., you wouldn't even have half of the number that China's turning out. That makes sense?
Yeah. So, and also it has to do with how quickly they can get them, right? I mean, that, like with the iPhone, it was going to have a plastic screen. And then, you know, famously, Jobs said at the last minute he wanted a glass screen. And Foxconn was able to accommodate that because of their flexibility.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So, like you said, they pulled like, you know, 10,000 people out of their beds and started, they started putting in on glass screens instead of in plastic screens. And that's because they, you know, the factories in these massive mini cities where they have huge plants, you know, up to like, I think 750,000 people living in these places. And it's hugely flexible. You know, the final assembly plant, we're talking about final assembly plants, you know, that where they put the iPhone together, they put the battery in and then the motherboard and some other components. And then the screen goes on top. And, it's all done by hand. You know, it's a big myth that this is done by robots. They're trying to automate it, but they're not quite there yet. Almost all the assembly is done, and this is not just true of Apple, but almost all high-tech products, is done by hand, and it's really kind of low-tech. They just set up these long lines of tables, and, you know, someone takes the case and puts a battery in, and it goes to the next person, and they put the next component in, and it goes to the next person, and they put the next component in. Depending on how many iPhones they're going to be assembling, you know, they'll have hundreds of these lines, sometimes thousands in several different factories. You can only do this in an operation like Foxconn, you know, where they have people who are living on the factory campus. You know, there's thousands and thousands of them. And if they get a big order for tens of thousands of or millions of iPhones, you know, they can pull people off. They can immediately just set up these lines. They're really simple to set up. They can get thousands of people to work on them, and they can train them in a couple of days, you know, what they need to do. And you could just, you know, can you imagine doing that here in the States, you know, setting up a factory somewhere and then recruiting people and trying to get them to do that? You can't. It's impossible. It can only be done under that model.
Mm-hmm. And so many people had never heard of Foxconn until the New York Times report, which was approved by Apple, as all press is. But then that was when people started to question, like, really, how many people do have to touch this device before I get it? And people started to feel, just to question our attention or, you know, our need to keep upgrading. And then, of course, there was the Mike Daisy play, the Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, which you originally gave a good review to on Cult of Mac. I looked it up and it made you question, like, oh, I felt guilty about my iPhone. And many of his details have been, you know, he admitted to lying about them. But there's still some issues, right? There's still some things for us to really think deeply every time we get a new iPhone, how they're made.
Yeah. Well, I think Mike Daisy, you know, he shone a light on a very, very important issue that wasn't getting taken seriously, you know, that people weren't really looking at. And I think he held Apple's feet to the fire, and he was, the way he presented his monologue was, it was all first person, and he was talking as though he went and talked to these people face to face. And it turned out that he had fabricated that he actually hadn't done that, that he'd taken these reports, you know, secondhand, and had injected himself into them, and presented as though someone was telling him face to face. And so it was kind of an odd situation, you know, Apple fans, Apple people who buy Apple products, you know, people who read the website, the Cult of Mac, they don't want to hear this kind of stuff about Apple. They don't want to hear this kind of stuff about Steve Jobs. You know, it's a kind of an ugly truth. It's something that you don't want to, you know, you want to bury your head about. And I think Mike Daisy, like I said, you know, he shone a light on a very important issue. And then he got attacked for the way he did it, which I think, you know, it allowed Apple to sort of sidestep it. You know, they weren't really, the issue became about Mike Daisy rather than the things he was talking about, which I thought was a shame. Mm-hmm. But since then, you know, I mean, one of the things that, I don't know if you want to talk about this now, but, you know, they've really done, and Tim Cook's really done a lot and really cleaned up the supply chain. It's definitely not the same supply chain that he inherited or, you know, I guess helped build, 10 years ago. But when Steve Jobs was around, you know, he didn't really, Jobs paid lip service, you know, it really wasn't an issue for him. And I think Tim Cook, with his blue collar background, his background of working in factories, coming up through IBM, you know, spending more than a dozen years on shop floors, you know, it did matter to him. And I think he's made some really important changes, some really important reforms.
I mean, of the many things, I mean, people always think, okay, well, the Apple Pencil would never have been charged outside of the the iPad if, you know, Jobs were alive, or all these things about products. But I really wonder what would have happened if he had still been around in terms of this, because I mean, you write about in the book about how Cook worked with the Fair Labor Association. He was the first tech company to do that. And they audited the factories and they did make a lot of changes. And what if, you know, how would Jobs have fared now in the age of social media? I mean, you think about Elon Musk and, Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg, and like, where would he have fallen in that? And because by all accounts, he kind of said whatever he felt like saying all the time, and people don't accept that so much anymore.
Well, Steve Jobs, you know, he's very disciplined, and I think he's the opposite of like someone like Elon Musk. You know, I mean, like Jobs is never going to, you know, take to his Twitter stream and start spouting, you know, whatever came off the top of his head. You know, he was much, much more disciplined.
But how do
that,
we know he didn't use Twitter, really? I mean, did he? I guess.
Well, Twitter was around. I mean, social media's been around for a while. And if you look at, you know, like Jobs only came out, his keynotes were really his forum for speaking to the public. And, you know, he would practice for months obsessively. Every single slide, was pored over and agonized over. You know, he didn't do anything off the cuff. I mean, he hardly even made any jokes that weren't rehearsed, mm-hmm. In his product presentations. But, you know, the point about, you know, would he have cared about these issues? No, I don't think so. I think this is what's interesting about Tim Cook, and this is why he's, you know, like one of the most important CEOs, if not the most important CEO that Apple's ever had, is because, you know, he's bringing these values and changing this massive corporation that I think was indifferent to these things. you know, it was indifferent to the supply chain. It didn't, you know, like Jobs, I think, was mortified that, 12 people committed suicide and would he'd loved that issue to have gone to bed. Like, he did not like dealing with that and did not know how to deal with it and didn't deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, they made some changes, but the big changes didn't really come until after Jobs passed and Tim Cook took over. And then he really got serious about, you know, the enforcing Apple's supplier code of conduct. Holding the suppliers' feet to the fire, cutting them off if they made too many infractions. It really got serious under Tim Cook, and it wasn't under Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that you're right that he said, you know, we're on top of it, we're on this or something, isn't that what
yeah.
Jobs said? So maybe he'd be more of like a Travis Kalanick, like the former CEO of Uber, like more of his, I don't know. I just wonder what he would have, how he would have fit in and all that. I mean, yeah, I guess more Zuckerberg doesn't really necessarily say stuff, but he seems to care more about humans than Jobs
did. Are you kidding? You're joking, aren't you?
Zuckerberg's
the opposite. He's a complete monster. He cares nothing about, he's a robot. I mean, he's much, much worse than Jobs. Jobs at least had some kind of, you know, like empathy that was expressed through products, but Zuckerberg's far worse.
I feel like he does, in his heart of hearts, believe that he's doing good. I don't think he is.
I don't believe that at all.
You don't think he believes that?
No, no, not for a second. Not with Zuckerberg, no.
Yeah.
I don't think Zuckerberg's got a, you know, I think he likes to stick his name on a hospital and pay $75 million to do that, you know, and sort of do these kind of, these things that are doing lip service. But like his recent, you know, the whole pivot towards privacy, it's because that's what, you know, right. It's another ripoff of Snapchat. You know, they're just, they're copying Snapchat's business model again. And it's clear that, you know, people want more, that young people aren't using Facebook. You know, they're abandoning it in droves for things like, you know, for these more private communication channels. Mm-hmm. So he's just responding to the market. I don't think he's not doing this for, you know, for the good of humanity at all.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess his robot act fooled me.
You know, and I think Steve Jobs, you know, where Steve Jobs fits into that. And I mean, Jobs was a very odd, you know, he's such a fascinating character, so full of so many contradictions, mm-hmm. you know, because he really was a bastard mm-hmm. and he really was a sociopath. He really didn't care for people, even people in his own life. Look at it. Look at the terrible account from his own daughter mm-hmm. and how she was treated. I mean, you know, she was treated like an accessory, like a pet. She wasn't treated like a human being. Mm-hmm. He didn't really have that in his heart. And it was just sort of incapable of that. He was a sociopath.
Well, I don't think that Zuckerberg is a sociopath. I guess that's what I'm saying. Like, he seems to be think he's doing good and want to do good and also keep the bottom line.
Well, Jobs is able to do good through his products, oddly, right? Yeah, you know, yeah. I think, you know, Apple products, look at, I mean, they're remarkable things. You know, they people will accuse them of being too expensive and too well designed and sort of elitist and kind of, you know, aspirational. But they're mm-hmm. they're not really. I think, you know, like the genius of Jobs' products going all the way back to like the Apple II and the Mac, you know, was to democratize this high technology. They really were for the masses. You know, they were for regular people. And that's why he insisted so much on simplicity, on one-button mice, and all that kind of stuff that drove people crazy. But you could walk, you know, a kid could walk up to it, a grandmother, a teacher, you know, anybody. I remember getting the first iPhone, and my kids grabbed it, you know, and they had it worked out in a few minutes, you know, and they were showing me all this stuff you could do. It's so intuitive. You don't need a manual. You don't need someone to show it to you. You just pick it up and you play with it, and it's, you know, and it's obvious what it does, even if it's something as new as you know, like a multi-touch smartphone. And that was his genius, you know. Mm-hmm. That was, and he had real empathy. That was like that does take crazy empathy, you know, a very emphatic mindset that wasn't born out in the way he treated people at all. Mm-hmm. So odd and contradictory. He's such an interesting person. But anyway, to get back to Tim Cook, I mean, I think Tim Cook, you know, he's an unlikely person to make, he's making Apple a very, very progressive company. Mm-hmm. And he's doing all the things that I think people used to project onto Steve Jobs. I mean, Steve Jobs was like a hippie, you know, he's California hippie, long hair, super good looking. He dated rock stars, you know, he was had weird diets. He seemed to be the epitome of, you know, the sort of like California left coast cool. And yet the company he founded and ran was, you know, it was like a big, really kind of ruthless money making machine. And it really didn't do much for the environment or for, inclusion, diversity, education, the supply chain. And these are things that have really changed under Tim Cook, you know, the last few years, quietly and really quite remarkably. He has been turning Apple into this vessel for making some quite important changes, I think, in the way that American, that companies like as big as Apple do business and do things like make products. You know, they're running on 100% renewable power is big and important. I think a really big and important change.
So one big moment in his career has to be San Bernardino, the privacy encryption debate, which, as you write, they were really just waiting for, they knew this would happen. The encryption problem started with iOS 8, and they had, the police had already talked to Apple and said, we want you to be able to open these phones in general. And Cook had said no. And then here was this case where people had died, and the person with the iPhone, the terrorist with the iPhone had died and had an iPhone, which I think is rare for terrorists in general. And so this was the perfect storm. Talk a little bit about how Cook handled that big encryption case.
Yeah, they got a writ from a court down in San Bernardino asking them to work with the FBI to create a special version of iOS that would bypass the number lock on the home screen lock. And Apple and Tim Cook, refused. They were worried that creating such a thing would become like a Pandora's box. It would become like once they created such a thing, they wouldn't be able to control it. They were worried that it would be able to get out live and undermine everyone's security. So Tim Cook, when they got this writ, he and half a dozen others, as I detailed in the book, I talked to Bruce Sowell, the Apple's chief lawyer, who was in the room at the time, and they had this emergency counsel. And they immediately realized that this was sort of, could be a really serious threat to Apple and their stance, their stance to take this stance and say that, no, we won't work with the FBI was really, really risky. They didn't want Apple to be seen, to be portrayed as siding with terrorists, but they felt that there was a more important issue at stake, which is to maintain the security of everyone's devices. And the privacy of everyone's devices, and that is was a far more important point than this than bending over backwards to accommodate this one particular investigation. And so it's a point of principle that I think initially the public was against them. Donald Trump, who was a candidate then for the presidency, made a couple of speeches where he attacked Tim Cook and Apple for not working with the FBI and painted in very sort of simplistic terms, sort of saying that they're siding with terrorists, they're not helping law enforcement. Whereas, the real point was a far more complex. And, for the next 6 weeks or so, Apple went on to, and Tim Cook, did a very determined campaign, public education campaign, to try to tell people why they were doing this, why it was important that people have privacy and security and that they shouldn't provide a backdoor to law enforcement. And I think they did a really good job. There was one pivotal point when he went on ABC and gave a big interview to ABC. And that, I think was the first time that people really sort of saw Tim Cook. I think it was one of his first really, really big interviews. And they saw that, he was a thoughtful and competent leader of a big company and that his principal position was really defensible. And eventually they prevailed. The FBI managed to get an Israeli company to hack in a backdoor, and without that, they didn't have a good legal footing to force Apple to comply with their order. So they had to drop the case.
So it was a success for Cook, but it was a success for Apple overall. Like, he won, but he was upset not being able to go forward with the case, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a Pyrrhic victory. They haven't really, nothing's really been resolved. That one particular case, they weren't forced to do what the FBI wanted them to do, but it's still unresolved. It was, Tim wanted the courts to sort it out. He wanted to have a ruling. He wanted to have a legal ruling. So it was on, he wanted the courts to figure out what to do in this case, When they dropped the case, it was undecided, and it's still undecided, and it's still actually an ongoing issue. And in fact, you know, it's coming up again. You know, people with Facebook, Zuckerberg's announcement they're going to make Facebook and WhatsApp and Instagram, you know, end to end encrypted. It's going to come up again. I mean, there's always going to be a tension between, you know, privacy and security and things like, you know, law enforcement and terrorist investigations and criminal investigations. You know, criminals can use these tools to plan robberies and commit crimes. As everyone else is talking to their family. The fact that it's, you know, that we need this, and you know, I'm a firm believer that we do need this encryption. That it's an insoluble problem. I mean, it's something that's very difficult to solve. If you give a backdoor to some people, you give a backdoor to everyone. You know, they're not secure. There's no such thing as giving the government a secure backdoor. Mm-hmm. It will, you know, come to haunt them, you know, when someone they don't want it gets access to it.
I said earlier that it's rare for terrorists to have iPhones. I don't know that statistic at all. I cannot back that up with any facts. I just think that this this is interesting because it wasn't even his personal phone for the
right.
shooter. Yeah. It was his work phone. And I wonder, is that why this hasn't – why hasn't it come up again? Why haven't we seen this case come up again?
Like publicly? Yeah, that – I haven't, you know, followed it. I'm sure it must. I'm pretty sure it's come up. It must have come up, and especially in criminal investigations, it just hasn't made. You know, we haven't had a big national or international news story where you know the revolt around this. But you know, at the time when the San Bernardino was looking into it, I mean, the New York cops were looking into. There was a case where a couple of officers were shot in New York, and the shooters, the cops wanted access to the shooter's phone and had been petitioning Apple to help them get into that. And there was another case, I think, around the same time. I forget where it was, but, you know, at the same time as the San Bernardino shooting, you know, there were at least two or three ongoing cases here in the States, let alone, you know, elsewhere. And I'm pretty sure it's, you know, I know it's an ongoing issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there's drug dealers. It's also things we hear about are the terrible people, not all the good ways that encryption has helped whistleblowers or just other, you know, people, you know, women who are in the case of abuses, you know, all kinds of good ways that encryption has really helped people, besides it just being something that we should have the right to. So,
right.
So diversity, accessibility, environmental issues. I mean, Cook has been on the forefront of all of those and really pushing and showing that a successful company can also do those things. Talk a little bit about like the $1 trillion valuation and who is that? It took place under Cook's reign, I guess. I mean, is he who we should really thank for that much money? Yeah. The company should thank. I'm not getting that much money.
Yeah, well, shareholders. Yeah, shareholders should thank for that. Yeah, absolutely. You know, Tim Cook has now introduced more iPhones than Steve Jobs introduced. Since he took over, the stock has more than doubled, and the revenue has also more than doubled. And people were saying, you know, around the time when he took over that Apple was already big and that he was going to have trouble with the law of big numbers, you know, to make any sort of significant increase on a company that's making, you know, $80 billion every quarter. You've got to sell a lot of iPhones. You've got to sell a lot of products, you know, to make any kind of dent on that. And yet they have, you know, they continue to grow everything. They had that first stumble, this last, the holiday quarter for last year, the end of 2018, when they sold fewer iPhones than they expected in China, and they took a hit on their earnings then. And you know, there's a lot of people blamed Tim Cook for that, saying, "Oh, you know, here it is, it's the end, and we've reached peak iPhone. You know, the run is over." And it was significant, you know, because it's the first time in more than 10 years that there was actually a decline in sales. It's been growing and growing and growing every quarter, every year. It's the best. Someone described it as the best business ever made. You know, they've sold so many. It really has been not just technically, but culturally transformative. Who doesn't have a smartphone? The smartphone is the people's computer. And if it's not an iPhone, it's a pale ripoff of an iPhone. It's an Android phone, right? So it's really has been transformative. And Cook, I think he was the major architect of the manufacturing operation that turned it into such a behemoth. And he's, continued to grow it at a massive, massive way since then. And I think people sort of, they don't give him credit for that. It's kind of strange. They think, oh, yeah, it was all Steve Jobs' idea and he did all the work and Tim's just writing his coattails. But he was not only an architect of it in the first place, but, so growing it to this size is no mean achievement.
Well, we only touched the basics in your new book, and I highly recommend that if anyone's interested, because it really is not stuff that you can just find out there, because he hasn't done any major profiles, and it is just the way that you put all the pieces together. It's a great book. Tim Cook, The Genius Who Took Apple to the Next Level, by Leander Caney, and also founder of Cult of Mac, so you can find the book wherever books are sold. And there's also an audiobook?
Yes, yeah, there is, yeah.
Do you read the audiobook?
No. It was done by a professional.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. And you can also check out all of Leander's other books online. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Megan. Thanks so much.
And thank you for joining us. Every week we record Triangulation around Friday, usually Fridays. Sometimes other days you can subscribe whenever and get it whenever you want to get it on any. You can watch or listen, whatever way you get podcasts. We will be there, and we'll see you next week on Triangulation.